Sunday afternoon, and it's time once again for Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis, and this is one of those occasions when Kathy Smith Bowers joins me in the studio. It is another, yes, a Laureate's Poetry Hour. Thank you, Kathy. Welcome. Good to see you here.
Thank you, Jeff.
You're looking wonderful as usual.
Thank you. You're not so bad yourself.
Here, you've got a special program.
I do have a special program.
Planned today.
I do. Thank you for mentioning that. So I'll start by saying that I first met Jeff Davis when I was invited to be a featured poet on Wordplay. Since then, I've continued to be impressed by Jeff's generous dedication to poetry and to all the arts, and to his own life as a poet and scholar. And I was especially delighted when Jeff agreed to let me do a Laureate's Hour once a month on Wordplay. But I also warned him that I was going to turn the tables on him and have him as my featured guest one night. So,
oh, whoa.
Tonight is the night. Welcome, Jeff Davis.
Oh, thank you, Kathy. It's wonderful to be here, I guess.
So, Jeff, I really do admire you for your dedication. Your not only your life as a poet and scholar, but your dedication, your generous dedication to the arts. So, will you share with us a little bit about the history of your connection with wordplay and the arts in Asheville?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. It's funny. I was sort of active in the Asheville poetry scene, such as it was back in the 70s, but there wasn't much happening. And then dropped out of the poetry scene, dropped out of involvement with the arts for 20 years or something like that, maybe a little bit more. And then in 2002, happened to attend a panel that was presented by the Black Mountain College Museum and Arts Center, and it featured some alumni of Black Mountain College.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fascinating. And, of course, I realized it was actually the first encounter I'd had with that organization. And so I started working with it. They put on a poetry festival. Actually, my first occasion was probably in 98 or 99, somewhere in there. And then 2002, there was a festival. And they didn't have anybody to coordinate poets. And so since I'd studied with the Black Mountain College poet, Robert Creeley,
mm-hmm.
I made a few phone calls, rounded up some poets. And from then on, have been pretty much, you know, involved with the poetry scene mm-hmm. since. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's been fascinating. It's been fascinating to watch it grow and evolve and change mm-hmm. and get much more diverse and much more interesting over the years.
Right.
So, yeah.
And so you've been involved with wordplay.
Yeah, since the beginning, which was 2005.
Oh, okay.
There was a group of us who got together. Now, this is at another radio station, which will be nameless, shall we say.
Could you give us the initials?
Oh. But a group got together, and Joanne Coates, bless her heart, sent me an email and said, you know, you might want to be involved with this. And so I said, well, yeah, sure. It was a bunch of people who wanted to do a poetry show mm-hmm. on radio. And I said, well, yeah, makes sense mm-hmm. to me. Because, of course, I'd been recording poets on analog tape and then later digitally since the 70s when I used to make road trips to like record Robert Creeley and Ed Dorn and mm-hmm. all those cats. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, yeah, why not? It might be interesting to do. Mm-hmm. And that first year was a really interesting process. Stephanie Pazuski was in the committee.
Oh, yes.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Joanne herself, whom you haven't met yet, but another, and she's still involved here at Asheville mm-hmm. FM. So, you know, and Pat Revere Seal
mm-hmm.
Was involved in the same group.
Okay.
So there was a horde of us.
Yeah.
And after the first year, and of course you, Stephanie, brought you onto the show first year.
Yeah.
In October
right.
of that year. Mm-hmm. Right. Bless her heart.
Yep.
And that was my first encounter with your work.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, yeah, the second season, everybody dropped out except me. So they went on to do other programs
yeah,
and so on.
Yeah. Well, there again is your dedication shining through. So you're doing good stuff.
Well, thanks.
So, Jeff, I'm looking now at your beautiful book, Natures. This is Selected Poems 1972 to 2005. And you... Not only is the book just absolutely gorgeous, I'm so drawn
thanks.
To your lyrical voice because I myself I tend to be more of a narrative poet, and so I always admire somebody who can write beautiful lyric poems, and you definitely do. But I'm looking at the preface to Natures, and it begins, "The work of poetry is a relentless preparation for ecstasy. The work of poetry is a relentless preparation for ecstasy. And it brings to mind that, you know, the meaning of the word ecstasy, ecstasis, is out of stasis. So you later say, in a moment of ecstasis, the poet stands outside the ego and its various preoccupations and delusions, key word there, I think, in order to hear his or her inspiration, the breath of imagination, the spirit, the muse, whatever she or he might have to say. The breath of imagination, the spirit, the muse, whatever she or he might have to say. So I wondered if you would comment a little bit on that, and then I especially want you to read your beautiful poem called To the Muse.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Yeah. Well, I do think poetry at its best moves us from where we are and opens us up to new recognitions and possibilities, and that's the way it moves us from stasis, from where we happen to be situated.
Stasis, static.
Static, mm-hmm. Right. And it moves us, and it gets us moving. Mm-hmm. And so that seems to me the continual job of poetry.
I agree. I love that. And I love how you express that in the preface to this book.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
So, would you read To the Muse?
Yeah. Let me dig that one up. This is actually, curiously, even though it's way down in the book, wherever it is.
Page 34.
Okay, thank you.
Quite welcome.
This was actually the first poem I wrote for the book. Not thinking of it as being a poem for a book, but this is the first poem where I came to this voice, I suppose one should say. And I wrote it on a ferry in British Columbia on my way to a little village called Alert Bay from Vancouver.
Oh, wow.
That's where I started it. And so let me just read it, and then I'll talk about some of the bizarre stuff that went into it. To the Muse. I wanted to take you to a place I did not know the way past name's mask to your face. Lost, amazed, I came to your words on a rock. Waited. Meet me. I went on to a place I thought you made a bed. We moved on an arc of blood through sleep. Silent, you gave me a dream of your naked eyes. My lost home. No place it was. I came to you.
Beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah.
There are just so many little things you do with language in this poem that are intriguing and take us out of stasis.
Yeah.
And lift us up and make us think. And the idea of place, I wanted to take you to a place I did not know the way past names, masks, to your face. There's such beautiful internal rhyme. What you do with sound.
Oh, thank you.
In itself is ecstatic. But I also am intrigued with that ending. Silent, you gave me a dream of your naked eyes, my lost home. No place it was. I found you.
And which I changed in reading to, I came to you.
I came to you. Why did you do that? Have you revised this poem?
I have revised
already?
This poem. Uh-huh. This is when I after
you're Bonarding the poem as the poet Bonnard used to do to his paintings. He'd go
That's
around
right.
and change
right.
them,
even though
they were
on
hanging
the wall.
On other
right.
people's walls.
Right. It's funny, after when I published Natures in 2006, There were some poems I had not read aloud in 20, 30 years, probably, something, you know, long time. And when I read them aloud, I suddenly had readings to do, and I had a chance to read them aloud. And sometimes just for this, the sound, I want to say, the flow of the poem, I have changed a word or two. And mm-hmm. I really should put those up somewhere on mm-hmm. the blog. And if I ever do another, mm-hmm. if these ever get reprinted or whatever, mm-hmm. I'd certainly incorporate those changes.
Okay, so in the book, it's this the page I'm looking at, the mm-hmm. poem, "No Place It Was I Found You."
Right.
And what you just read was, "I came to you."
Right.
So there's this whole idea then about, does the muse come to us, or do we go to the muse, or... And why mm-hmm. do you have the word place italicized?
No, place, place. Was I came to you. Partly for emphasis, and but also...
Because it's not about place, it's about
right.
state of mind,
exactly.
state of spirit.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, right. I wanted, it's not that the muse was not there, it's that, that there was no place involved. I remember that we both listened to Mark Doty read last
yes.
night, and
mm-hmm.
The last line of one of his poems, "The House of Beauty," this wonderful recent poem, "The House of Beauty is a house of flame."
Yes.
And
that sounds such like such a platonic line, but it was about a beauty shop burning
right,
down.
Right, yes,
somebody
right.
had burned down a beauty shop.
Right, right. Named the House of Beauty.
Yes.
So it's a wonderful poem, and what I wanted to say is that the muse is not about place. It's not about finding a location or coming to arriving at a place. Where there's something there,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's a flame.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a matter of movement.
Yeah.
I guess I was working with, had the good fortune when I was in Buffalo of working with Robert Greeley, auditing his classes and, you know, getting to know him socially as well. And Greeley was very concerned with conditions of meaning. He was so aware of language, you know. A word used in one context means one thing, and used in another context, it means another.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was working with that, with the conditions of meaning involved with the words in the poem
mm-hmm.
as I went,
mm-hmm.
which is why it seems to unfold in a curious way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's.
Yeah. And it does. And a lot of your poems unfold in curious,
mm-hmm.
wonderfully curious ways. And. Another poem that I really love in this book, Strata Melissa, as every time I read this book, I think of what a Renaissance man you really are, because your poems, I realize as I'm reading your work that you draw from so many areas, botany, mythology, astronomy, philosophy, anything that ends with a Y, anthropology, geology, history, Jungian psychology, it's all wrapped up.
All those logoi.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It's just layer upon layer of this richness. And
You caught me.
I see that especially in this beautiful poem, Strata Melissa. I would love for you to read this poem, but you got some splaining to do. I mean, not that the beauty of it is that the poem, it moves me. It that ecstasis takes place, and yet every time I read it, I see something else that has that blossoms, that opens up for me. So I'd love for you to read this to us.
Okay, well, I will. Maybe I should say a few words about it.
Okay.
This is when I moved to Asheville back in the 70s. I think I moved here in 74. One of the startling things, facts of this place is the presence of rhododendrons
mm-hmm.
And azaleas. You know, and azaleas are all over the South, but rhododendrons are specific to the Appalachian Mountains. They only grow here. In Oregon and Washington, British Columbia, there are a few species there. Natively, I mean, they're now, hybrids everywhere. But and then they grow in China, Tibet, that area. That's where they appear to be native to. And then there's one other place they grow, and that's on the shores of the Black Sea. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So one of the things in, and I was, you know, I actually grow to, I'm fascinated by rhododendrons. I love them. They're great, great, wonderful things. And they're really an ancient cultivar. And one of the bits of curious lore as I was reading about rhododendrons that I ran across was this story of how there's a type of honey that's made, that the bees make. You know, it's not a human creation. It's something that bees make from the flowers of the rhododendron in northern, what's now northern Turkey, that's hallucinogenic. And it's melechloron, the green honey. And human beings who live in that area have been aware of its properties, of course, for thousands of years. But those who aren't from there don't always know it. Mm-hmm. And so the folks who live there at various times have employed it as a weapon and employed it as such against Roman legions. They would leave out gifts of honey. And after the Romans consumed the honey, thinking, oh, these guys are okay, you know, yeah, they love us, they're glad we're here, then they would wait about an hour until the Romans were just tripping their brains out and sick as dogs and, you know, just otherwise suffering the effects of the green honey. And then they would descend on them and slaughter them. And so, yes.
And you allude to the good doctor in here.
So. Yeah, the good doctor is Tim Leary. Right. Yes, okay. This is about, this is a poem about hallucinogens and various and sundry or entheogenics or whatever one calls them. And it explores that the paradox of sweetness and treachery and, you know, all this other kind of stuff too. Yeah, but the good doctor is Tim Leary, who's may or may not be real good. I don't know. he had his upside and his downside,
good,
I guess.
Something.
But he was good. Mm-hmm. And he was of course one of the first to introduce hallucinogens, psychedelics, to our culture. So one of that first wave. Most of the Greek terms in the poem are translated in line. The pharmakon is just the ancient body of medicinal lore. Most of it related to plants.
Yeah. One of the things I love about this poem is that you do, even though you're calling on so many different areas of knowledge, you do help the reader out. You give us enough information that we don't feel like total idiots.
Well, that's good.
Just semi-idiots. No, it is a beautiful poem. I'd love to hear you read it.
Okay. I should say there's an extended quote in here from Charles Boer's translation of the Homeric hymn to Hermes. And the poem also draws on the work of Gordon Wasson and Carl A.P. Ruck in The Road to Eleusis and Persephone's Quest. Both great, great books if you're interested in the pursuit of the sacred and ecstasis. So here it is, I guess, Strata Melissa. For all its sweetness, the honey of the rose tree is treacherous and must be taken just so. Set and setting, the good doctor said, decisive. The green honey, melechloron, from the spring of the year, when the flowers of the rhododendron open, poison, even the ancients knew, sheep's bane, lamb's gill, speak to the lethality of the leaf's alkaloids, and bees took these from the flowering to their combs. Roman legions marching through the Caucasus, not familiar with the pharmakon, ate the honey, left for them as a parent gift near Trebizond. When they were stoned, stumbling, sick, dizzy, delusional from its sweet sting, the villagers returned to hack them down. Hundreds never descended the inner promontories they had climbed. Bodies left on rocks beside trails to turn slowly into bones. But taken otherwise, as the bee girls, Melissae knew its ways, honey on their tongues stood through veils between worlds, words, and spoke oracles. There are certain holy ones dwell under a ridge at Parnassus, Apollo said, teachers of foreseeing. When they are inspired, eating melichloron, speak truth. Inquire of them and delight your heart. Melissa, your honey on my tongue, do come make sweet my song.
Oh, that's just beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
It really is a poem that just opens up a little bit more every time I read it.
Oh.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Yeah. All right. Well, let's take a little break.
Okay.
Paradise waits on the crest of a wave of angels and flame. She has no pain. Like a child, she's pure, she is love to play. Poised for flight, wings spread wide, bring from night into the sun. Don't stop to run. She can fly like a lion, she can't be outdone. Tell me the cost. I can pay, let me go, tell me love is not lost. Tell everything. Without love, day-to-day insanity's king.
Back to Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis, and actually I'm not your host today. Kathy Smith Bowers is playing that role, so we'll turn the program back over to Kathy.
Yes, I have turned the tables on Jeff Davis tonight. He needs to get some attention now. Jeff, in June you're presenting a paper in Vancouver on the poet Charles Olson. Tell us a little bit about how your interest in Olson came about.
Ah, okay, yeah, sure. Yeah, that's the Olson Centennial Conference being held at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia, one of my favorite cities in the world. My interest in Olson actually started when I was in Chapel Hill. It's funny because here I was, this good, straight Southern boy, grown up in Charlotte, rather bourgeois kid, you know, and I go to Chapel Hill, and I'm reading both the good poets, you know, the approved poets of the era, who were mostly the confessionals. I mean, mm-hmm. Randall Jarrell, Robert Lowell, and then Sylvia Plath came along and mm-hmm. kind of transformed that whole scene in a wonderful way. But I was also reading the bad poets, you know, that is the poets that weren't part of the curriculum.
So it was Chapel Hill who turned you bad.
It's Chapel Hill that ruined me forever. That's right. It was my good friends, Norwood Pratt and, you know, Chris Munger and Rick Doble, and they just destroyed me. It was terrible, terrible to watch. But it was through these, associations with other poets, people, friends, you know, et cetera, that I came across the work of Robert Creeley and Charles Olson. Mm-hmm. And it was it's a curious thing. I mean, here's Chapel Hill, University of North Carolina. It's in Chapel Hill. It's in North Carolina, as you might imagine. And never did I hear a word in a classroom about Black Mountain College.
Wow.
You know, never mentioned.
Mm.
But in the meantime, the work of these poets who had been at Black Mountain College was catching on like wildfire among people who are really involved with writing mm-hmm. and with poetry. So it was through friends, you know, from places like New York that I came to the work of Robert Creeley that he had done at Black Mountain, you know, yeah. which was, mm-hmm. 15 miles from here.
Right.
And Charles Olson also. So, and then when I went to Buffalo, to visit some friends for a couple of weeks, and then I wound up staying for 3 years, you know. Those things happen. And it was partly because Robert Creeley was there. I'd missed Charles Olson because he had left the year before and gone back to Gloucester, though he was still living, and his spirit was very much there in Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people like Jack Clark were carrying on the teaching, and Creeley, of course, Robert Creeley, mm-hmm. Very much in an Olsonian mode. I mean, they were opening, you know, people's heads right and left.
Yeah.
So that's how I came to it. I think Olson's work is undervalued and still not appreciated to the mm-hmm. same degree that Creeley's. Creeley went on, of course, to great success,
right,
and
yeah.
became a poet
yeah.
laureate of New
mm-hmm.
York and,
right.
and taught for many years at the State University of New York at Buffalo and then later at Brown. And always attributed his, you know, his work with Olson, you know, was just that's the foundation in poetry for
right.
him.
And the anthology that I'm using now in one of my classes at Walford
right.
has Creeley.
But not Olson.
But not Olson.
Nary a bit of Olson.
Nary a bit of Olson.
Yeah, I thought, I remember looking at that anthology
right.
and saying, it didn't have Robert Duncan either, I don't believe,
no.
either. So it's like, no. yeah, yeah. None of the Black Mountain guys, except yeah. for Creeley, who uh-huh. went on, of course, to, to some a success in the world
a
as a poet.
Bit.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Not, well, could you read us something?
Sure, yeah, let me read you a little bit of Olson. And of course, Olson's mainly known for his Maximus poems, which I can't read you. It would take many hours. But, but this is one, like in, you know, the way we talk about poetry these days, in workshop terms, this is an ekphrastic poem. It's about, who's it, Donatello's Marine Venus. So, but it's also about the birth of his daughter. And so it combines these various conditions of meaning. It speaks from all of them at the same time. The ring of. It was the west wind caught her up as she rose from the genital wave and bore her from the delicate foam home to her isle. And those lovers of the difficult, the hours of the golden day, welcomed her, clad her, were as though they had made her, were wild to bring this new thing born of the ring of the sea, pink and naked. This girl brought her to the face of the gods, violets in her hair. This beauty And she said no to Zeus and them all. All were not, or was it that she chose the ugliest to bed with? Or was it straight and to expiate the nature of beauty, was it? Knowing ours anyway, she did not stay long. Or the lame was only one part, and the handsome Mars had her. And the child had that name, the arrow of, as the flight of, the move of, his mother who adorneth with myrtle the dolphin, and words they rise, they do, who are born of like elements.
Wow.
Yeah, I think that, you know,
what
is an amazing
poem.
What an
example of what T.S. Eliot called the objective correlative, you know, using that myth, that story, as an impetus for writing about his daughter.
Yeah, yeah.
That's just gorgeous. Yeah. I love the genital waves.
Yeah, the genital waves.
That's so beautiful.
Right. Yeah, it's a lovely poem. Yeah, and of course Olson and Eliot were not good buddies, but so
be that as it may.
Charles may be rolling over in his grave somewhere for but be that as it may.
All right, I take it back. I didn't say objective correlative.
It's curious, having grown up in an era when there were like schools of poetry, they were constantly at war with one another.
Yeah.
I mean, really, that were they were there would be like critical attacks, and
right.
You know, Robert Bly
uh-huh.
would make fun of Olson, you know, like, oh, the Maximus, reading the Maximus poems cures hemorrhoids and so on the back of the 60s
yeah.
magazine,
uh-huh.
you know, and now, I mean, the whole scene is so much more complex and diverse, and I don't know that there's that same.
I don't know. I with some of my colleagues, I see that, and sometimes I just look at them and say, who is it y'all so mad at?
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, right, yeah. And why exactly was it? Yeah, you know, I know.
Who is it y'all so mad at?
Yeah, yeah. It's a wild,
anyway,
wild and crazy scene.
I didn't
scene.
Say that.
Okay.
What a beautiful poem. Well, you know, at least for these few minutes, you brought Olson back to our attention.
Oh, well,
and
good.
You will do that in Vancouver.
That's the goal. That's
right.
The goal. Yep, yep. I'm looking forward to it. There are a lot of people who are going to be there presenting papers as well, whose work I've known for years, but I've never met. And so I'm really looking forward to meeting them and get to know them. Yep.
I wish I were going to be there.
I thought you were. It was my impression that you might be along. Well, yeah. I'm glad you are going to be there. But though you're going to be incognito.
I will be incognito.
So I understand.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, good.
Thank you for that lovely, lovely poem by Charles Olson.
That was a pleasure to share. Right, right. All right.
So,
let's have another tune.
All right.
Crossroads seem to come and go. Yeah, the gypsy flies from coast to coast. Melissa, yeah. Freight train, each car looks the same. Melissa.
It's Wordplay once again. You're
kind of,
yeah, I'm not your host anymore. This is, your host today is Kathy Smith Bowers.
He's host and guest.
Yep.
Jeff, your book in progress is called Carnelian Ghost. I really look forward to that book.
Oh, thank you.
I love that title. It's such an evocative title, Carnelian Ghost. Can you tell us a little bit about
it? I was intrigued with the word carnelian, which actually an artist friend, Betty Clark, suggested. It's because it's such a curious word. And if you know the color, if you're a painter, mm-hmm. you know, if you have a, it's kind of a flesh tone. And it's carnelian because it comes from carne, from flesh, the word for flesh.
Uh-huh.
And but it's also a stone. The carnelian is a flesh-covered stone, a flesh-colored
stone.
Yeah,
okay.
Not covered, but uh-huh. colored stone. So it has kind of multiple conditions of meaning in itself.
Uh-huh.
But I was intrigued by that play, the play that it offered.
Right, absolutely. It's a paradox.
It is.
Those two words together.
Yes, stone and flesh.
Yeah.
And of course, the ghost, or
ghost of flesh.
The ghost of flesh.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So yeah, it's coming along.
Well, yeah. When do you think it's going to be in the incarnation? No pun intended. To where we can actually hold it in our hands.
I think by this time next year.
Okay.
That's my hope, but. Yeah, we shall see. We shall see.
Well,
yeah.
Would you read us some
sure.
selections
I'd love to. Yeah. This is a poem called Echolocations, which is something that echolocation is something that bats use to find out where they are. They use their sonar, basically. They bounce sound waves off of things to locate themselves.
Because they can't see.
Because they don't see. Yeah. Right. Or it'll see very poorly.
The echo.
Yeah. So they listen to their echoes. And so this is, when I was in college years ago in Chapel Hill, we revisited that territory a little bit earlier, one of the professors I had was a scholar of Plato. And, he'd been thinking about Plato for many years and had just come to the conclusion that Plato's ideas were really not about things. They weren't about, the ideal chair or the ideal table or the ideal, washing machine or whatever. Not that they had washing machines in those days, but the platonic ideals.
There was always the form there.
That's right. The form, that's right.
Of the washing machine.
One would think, that's right. That an argument could be made for that, yes. But his belief was that Plato really was talking about relations, about the relationships of, like prepositions, like of, that the ideas were relational, that they were concepts that in our language does get conveyed by prepositions of, by, for,
under,
with,
over, beyond.
Under, over, beyond, and mm-hmm. so on. And so I was, working actually with some poems of Rilke and with and Rilke, if you know Rilke's work, he also he'll play with ideas, with concepts, and with the concept of something being high, for instance, or et cetera, et cetera. And I guess I was reading Rilke because I'd been working with some Orpheus themes, and of course Rilke is one of the great, great writers who's dealt with Orpheus as a entity, as a phenomenon, as a myth, as a concern.
Objective correlative.
As an objective correlative. That's right. Yeah.
I just wanted to say it again.
I thank you for that. So anyway, these echolocations came out of that concern. Always I followed the flickering of attention's light, and whatever came to mind became the only evidence of what it was I came to find. So what I did is done past all pretense otherwise, and lives only in the instant's eye. The ghost glimmers now as each carnelian surprise emerges out of time's penumbral afterglow, long, long out of touch, but come to mind at last and known. 2. Is what's at hand not whole? Must it be up beyond all reach and sight, requiring the climb? 3. We look high where it's hid, whatever it is. 4. What's here, though apparently scattered, stands complete, given the integrity it finds in sight. What's here is whole. 5. When invisible, inside, no windows. 6. Did I give it up? Let it go? Was it ever mine to hold? 7. Who knows? Who cares? Who cares? Cares that someone does is always enough.
Mm. So that's where the title of the book comes from.
It is,
right?
Yeah. Though I've actually wound up, you'll find the word carnelian in a number of pieces in the book.
Okay.
Yeah. It winds its way through.
So it becomes ghostly.
It becomes ghostly, mm-hmm. Yes, like a little presence.
It haunts the book.
It haunts the book, yes. Mm-hmm. And let me share this with you. It's a poem that does not have the word carnelian in it, but deals with the ghostly nature of reality in some respects. And it's called Notes for Autumn. And it's for the artist Joyce Blanc. Now, Joyce is a wonderful painter, and her constructions, actually, one of them is on the cover of the book Natures. And there are 4 other photographs of her work. Her work is just amazing and evocative, and
it really
rich.
It's
rich
beautiful.
Work.
I just love that her work was used in this, on the cover and throughout.
Yeah,
it's the section.
That's right. The sections
pieces.
Also have it's, right.
They're just they have the look of woodcuts in a way.
Mm-hmm. And I owe that to Thomas Rengrove, my editor, who. When he read my poems, he had known Joyce's work, and he put the two together and said, these things work together.
It's a gorgeous
book. And he actually introduced me to Joyce, mm-hmm. and we got it all, had a fantastic conversation, have had fantastic conversations ever since, and she's a wonderful artist. Mm-hmm. If you don't know her work, check it out.
Yeah.
So this is for Joyce, and this is actually uses elements from a couple of her constructions. One of them, Deep Autumn Asheville, is actually featured in Natures. And Crown Conch is the one on the cover of the book. So this is for Joyce Blanc, Notes for Autumn. What if I say, the settled walking cane beside the window arrows into stellar absence, and the green path where it treads between two hills that rise in the hinted distances is lost. The sky is full of summer haze, not so much as the sea would fling into the azure, though the shell on the windowsill, still put to the ear, tells of waves' motion, the commotion at the end of another journey. And for that, there is a closure and a closeness. Or what if I say, listen, ancient children's voices echo in the garden, so many generations, their laughs long obliterated, sought refuge in the stones. And despite the solace they have offered, if we are very quiet on this afternoon of half sun, half shadow, we will yet hear. Is it from the orchard beside the wall where she met, in those days, her lover? Sounds of tears exploding in the dust, as discovered, she denied their love, silently cursed fate, and cried. Within the frame there is a life, and it is ours. All that we do, have done, have lost, forgotten, a simple window to conjure landscape's space and duration, field, and the history of action. And rumor echoes in these walls of the almost unremembered war against which they first rose. The sun on the garden still below releases into this window the myriad fragrances of September at dusk, each its own iridescent color. Columns frame the view beyond the window. Someone has just left the conchs, one broken, one whole, upon the window sill. The light still plays in the trees outside. Leaves reveal red hints, yellow, thinning. The earth is a sea of a different order. To the side, a tiny faucet drips simple water and reminds us that all this, all which appears to stand before us with all its echoes, rides the waveform of the earth as it crests and falls, and fallen finds itself immersed. Or what if I say,
wow. So, Jeff, do you consider that an ekphrastic poem? Because as I'm listening to you read that, I'm looking at the beautiful cover of Nature's.
And so much of that is right off there.
Yeah, it is gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous. So it was really such a pleasure to look at the cover of this book and then hear you write from that. And Joyce must be delighted.
I have not yet shared that poem with her.
I need
to send it to her.
It'll be in the book.
And it will be in the book.
So maybe it would be better if it would be surprised. So unless she's listening to us right now.
Right. You never know with radio.
Yeah, it won't be a surprise anymore.
Sorry about that, Joyce. It was going to be a surprise, but otherwise. Oh, well.
We have time for you to read us another one from your new book? Or?
I don't know. Let's see.
Or you could read another one from Nature's. Everybody should go out and get a copy of Nature's.
They should. They should get two copies.
Yes, they should.
Multiple copies. Give them to friends.
It's such a beautiful book.
Right. Make Thomas,
inside and out.
Make Thomas Raincrow very happy, my editor and publisher. All right. Here's a really new poem. Let me see if I can get it real fast. This is called The Courtship, okay? And it's a little bit different.
Okay.
Yeah. The Courtship. You're not an other woman's man, not married to anyone else, she specified, because I've been there, done that, no more. No, not any woman's man, he said. Not married to anyone, he thought, except... Even then, he thought he knew, to you. Her smell, it was, got him so faint, a sunbathed mix of bronze and apricots and transmuted fire seared the lining of his nose, his mind. Never mind coke, crack, or any junk, he thought. I want this. He knew then it was serious when she said, God, I love your smell, so like a man. Oh, he thought, she's hooked too.
Wow.
One night in the heat of love, she kicked all her panties off. They disappeared. She could not find them in the next day's light. When she'd gone, though, he did, and all winter long kept them close at hand to bring to mind that burning, almost sleepless night. Still writing love poems.
By God, I think something's turned you into a narrative poet.
It's amazing.
Telling stories now.
It's very strange.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Jeff Davis, thank you for being both guest and host.
Well, thank you so much, Kathy. Mm-hmm. It's been a treat. Wordplay for this week, folks. Thanks so much for tuning in. Check out naturespoetry.blogspot.com for more information. And be sure and like Kathy Smith Bauer's Facebook page. There you go.